This is the Impeachment Podcast at anationdeceived.org. And today is Wednesday, November 28th, 2007. And this is a conversation with Craig Barnes and Joel Hirshhorn. This is number 77, and it's titled, Can Article 5 of the U.S. Constitution Save Us?
When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation.
Hi, Joel. This is Craig.
Hi, Craig.
Good to hear your voice.
Thank you.
After reading your extensive email. It's good. So should we talk about it?
Sure.
Are you ready to talk about the Constitutional Convention?
Yes, be happy to. I believe
All right. Yes, clearly. Well, let me tell our listeners that we're talking to Joel Hirshhorn, National Press Secretary of Friends of the Article 5 Convention. Friends of the Article 5 Convention. And Joel, you probably have a website if people are interested in a constitutional convention where they can check in and find out more about you and the organization. What's the website?
It's foavc.org.
Say it again.
Yeah, it's the initials of the organization. So it's Friends of the Article 5 Convention, foavc.org.
There's an A in there that I don't know what come with. Friends of the Article 5, F-O-T.
F-O-A-V-C, Friends of the Article 5 Convention.
Ah, that's right. You leave the T out. Okay, the
yeah.
D. Good, great. Well, Joel, you've been communicating with people around the country interested in creating a constitutional convention under Article 5, federal convention. Pursuant to the federal constitution, and one of your positions begins as follows, quote, if you have come to the realization that our current political government system is fatally corrupt, dishonest, and rigged, and no longer serves the interests of we the people, is subservient elitist bipartisan plutocracy that funds the two major parties and their politicians, then it should be clear that we stand zero chance of necessary reforms coming from within that system. That's what you wrote to me. And I wrote to you that I thought that overstated the problem, that was a more egregiously depressed position than I have. But let's start out with you. Tell me what you're thinking, how you come to these rather drastic conclusions.
Well, I've been very active in public policy for a long time. I worked for the U.S. Congress for a number of years, and I worked for the National Governors Association. So I policy and government system, and concluded over a long period of time that American democracy, was decayed. That our political system had gotten so dishonest and corrupt that we no longer have an honest, trustworthy representative democracy. And I don't see this corrupt political system we have, the two-party stranglehold on that system in particular, I don't see that system providing us with the political reforms that we desperately need.
So you're thinking that a constitutional convention might be a way to jumpstart democracy again. Tell us how that would work.
Well, yes. I mean, eventually I came to understand that the founders of our country, the framers of the Constitution, were really obviously quite brilliant people. And one of the things they anticipated was that one day the public would lose trust in the federal government. And I think that day certainly has arrived. And they created this kind of, escape clause or, release valve, if you will, in the Constitution in Article 5. And that is, you know, what we call an Article 5 convention, or people will call it a constitutional convention. But basically, the convention was the way the founders, you know, foresaw that we could deal, particularly with a Congress that no longer faithfully represented the people, and a Congress that would no longer reform the political system and the government when it became necessary. So the founders gave us this option in Article 5. And I believe we ought to trust the Constitution, and that we ought to use this option that's in Article 5. We've never used it, and I think to understand the reasons why we've never used it, you know, are very important, and that is that the status quo political establishment does not want us to have an Article 5 convention. They feel threatened by it. And I think that tells an important story in itself. And, you know, for over 200 years, we have not had the shot at the convention. And even though the requirement that is set forth in Article 5 is simple and straightforward, and that requirement has more than been satisfied, and we can, you know, I can get into the details of what that requirement is, but basically enough states have asked for an Article 5 convention, and yet Congress has refused to convene a convention. And so all of the constitutional amendments that we have been proposed by Congress, and none of them obviously have been proposed through the Article 5 convention mechanism.
Tell us, let me interrupt, Joel, let me interrupt just to get you to clarify, how does the convention get called, and how many states have already called for it, and over what period of time have they called for it?
Well, the Article 5 is very clear that Congress has the authority to convene a convention. They must call the convention. And they're supposed to do that when two-thirds of the state legislatures have basically applied for a convention or petitioned Congress for a convention. And, in fact, over a number of years, all 50 states have requested a convention. There have been over 500 applications for a convention. And here's where we start to get into some interesting, you know, issues, because Article 5 itself is very clear in its language. It does not specify any time frame for when those applications have to be submitted, and it doesn't specify that the states must ask for, you know, a certain amendment in order to have a convention. None of that is there. And over the years, people have, you know, put their own interpretations and extrapolations on what Article 5 says. But Article 5 itself is crystal clear. The language is extremely simple. So our point of view is that, you know, we've had well over two-thirds of the states ask for a convention over the years, and it doesn't matter that those applications have flowed into Congress over many years. I might note that one of the amendments that has already been ratified for our Constitution, that ratification process took place over a very, very long period of time, I think maybe close to 200 years. So, you know, this idea that people want to add requirements to get a convention is nonsense. And I might note that Congress has never passed any law which somehow, you know, expands or explains or changes the requirements for an Article 5 convention. They've never proposed an amendment which would change Article 5 in terms of the convention option. So, yeah, we believe in a strict reading of exactly what Article 5 says, and, you know, not adding any additional requirements.
Who's the we in this case? How many are you in your organization, and how widespread are you?
Well, we're still a young organization. We're not even a year old. Originally, there were five of us, you know, call ourselves the founders, who eventually sort of contacted each other and realized we all had the same belief that, you know, we should have a constitutional right to have, which is this convention. And so we formed an organization. And you know, our membership has grown steadily. I actually haven't even checked, you know, what the latest membership is. It's, I think, approaching 1,000 members. You know, we have a very successful website. We have a lot of public interest in this because there are a lot of Americans who are very disgusted with our political system and the corrupt nature of it. and are very supportive of us having a convention.
How are the people who would attend the convention selected?
Well, that would be that's up to the states. The states, this is not specified in Article 5, the states would select their own delegates. And, you know, then the delegates would get together. And, you know, basically once the Article 5 convention is convened, it's outside the control of the Congress, the White House, the Supreme Court. It is, in essence, a temporary sort of fourth branch of the federal government. And it's up to the convention delegates to organize themselves, set their own agenda, discuss whatever they want to discuss, and eventually, if they want to, propose amendments to the Constitution. But after that, any proposed amendments have to be ratified just as if the amendments had been proposed by Congress.
But they have to be ratified by the states.
By three-quarters of the states. So that's a high hurdle.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a kind of safety net. You know, we obviously get a lot of concerns from people about, you know, some craziness or some nutty things that would come out of a convention. But there are a lot of safety nets, and, you know, one of the things the framers did was build in this ratification requirement so that it's very difficult to get any proposed amendment ratified by three-quarters of the states. And the other point that we always like to make is that, obviously, the nation's first Article 5 convention, or you can interpret it as the nation's second constitutional convention, would be under extreme, you know, public and media scrutiny. And that's kind of a safety net, too. I mean, you know, once the delegates got together, everyone would be watching this sort of democracy in action. And I think fears about some sort of strange or bizarre or crazy amendments, you know, coming out of the convention, those fears are just unfounded. And in fact, those fears have been intentionally sort of placed into the public consciousness by the political establishment we have now, who don't want us to have an Article 5 convention.
Let me raise a point that concerns me about this, which is that there is a rather broad swath of American opinion behind this current president's attempt to create what he calls the unitary executive, or an executive who unilaterally can declare war, and so long as his unilaterally declared war exists, mm-hmm. he has extraordinary powers. And this is a remarkable argument, and yet it is remarkable in the sense that it's quite out of step with our history,
yeah.
and the constitutional considerations at the beginning of this republic. And yet there seems to be a substantial proportion of the public willing to abide by this, willing to invest their own political chances in this approach, that it sounds like and is reminiscent of the sounding in the Senate of Rome at the time the Caesars took over. And when you've got a great popular leader, or a leader who has the control of the popular agenda, as president has, no matter who he is or she is, when there's a sense, as even in Hillary Clinton's case, that national security is more important than civil rights, when that whole broad swath of American opinion is willing to give away these rights, is it not a considerable danger that with Fox News and Rupert Murdoch and CNN and Wolf Blitzer hammering on the need for security, and Giuliani and the thousands like him, that we would see attendance at these at this Article 5 convention in such great numbers in favor of strengthening the executive that we would go backward rather than forward?
I totally disagree with you. I think you have it completely wrong, because I don't think most of the country at all supports this this position of an extremely powerful presidency. In fact, the reason why so many of us support an Article 5 convention is because we believe that the presidency has become too powerful. And that was not the vision of the founders. That's not the vision in the Constitution. Congress was supposed to be probably the more powerful branch of government. So I see the Article 5 Convention, which, remember, is more a sort of creature of the states, as the way to get back to our constitutional roots and cut back on the power of the presidency and
restore
the balance.
And of course, that's the point, that we would like very much to restore the balance, those of us who are interested in and recollect the constitutional history. But that's not my point. My point is that there is a broad swath of opinion willing to alter the Constitution and move it forward to an even more egregious executive.
I don't see the data for that at all. I don't see the evidence for that at all. I think that's not true. I mean, obviously, there is a portion of the public that might believe that, certainly does probably believe it. I think that's an extreme minority. I believe
How can you say that it's such an extreme minority when David Yu and John Yu and David Addington and the Vice President of the United States have been pushing in that direction? The neocon movement has been pushing in that direction, and Hillary Clinton is not willing to say no to that direction, and Democrats are not willing to stand up and say yes to a constitutional convention. If they are all mumbling and stumbling along the road toward greater executive powers, allowing FISA to be extended, the Patriot Act to be extended, what is the consciousness that you rely on? What is the data for your position that you rely on that the public is willing to stand up on its own in opposition to these trumpeting centers of power and take us back to where we were before? What's the data for that?
Well, I think the most important data, if you will, the most important fact is that I would say most of the country no longer has any faith in the two-party system. I agree with you. The Democrats, you know, have been cowards and have been useless. The Democrats have allowed, you know, the Bush administration to gather extreme amounts of executive power. So I'm a complete opponent to the two-party system that we now have, and I don't expect the Democrats to do anything particularly good for the country. I think they have sold out. You know, I'm a kind of a person that believes, you know, in what Ralph Nader said and what Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has said. Basically, the two parties are just two sides of the same coin. It's a corrupt two-party system. And that's why I'm a strong believer in the convention, because I think the convention, again, this is exactly why the convention was designed by the founders, as a way out of the sort of oppression of a Congress, you know, that just doesn't exert its power under the Constitution and lets the presidency gather too much power. So the convention is our only solution. I mean, I think we're in agreement. I don't have any confidence in the Democrats either. And, you know, if they take over the presidency, they won't cut back on the powers. They'll just use the greater powers that have been accumulated over time, particularly during the Bush administration. So if we don't trust the two-party system, if we don't have confidence in it, then, you know, how do we reform our government and our political system? And I say the only alternative legal one, I get a lot of emails from people, you know, saying that the only way we'll change is through violent revolution. Well, all I'm arguing for is a peaceful second American revolution that's achieved through the Article 5 Convention process.
Well, I think we're in substantial, though not whole, agreement on the problem that the Congress has been unresponsive. But there, the evidence that of a widespread support in this country for civil rights or human rights or compassionate rights or a compassionate agenda with health care built in and education built in, all of that is a bit iffy. So that if we're going to turn it over to the popular opinion of the moment, which can be jingoized into war and has been since the Spanish-American War repeatedly, World War One again, we've been jingoized into Vietnam and jingoized into Nicaragua and Guatemala and Grenada and now into Iraq. What's to protect us from those who control the major resources, the major propaganda resources, from taking hold of our constitutional convention and wielding remodeling the American system more in their image rather than more in ours?
Well, my first response is that those sort of evil powers that you refer to are already controlling our government. So, you know, my view is things are so bad now. I don't understand. If we see all of this sort of these evil forces controlling the government now, how can we expect reforms to come from the system that they now control? The one thing I do know is that they do not yet control an Article 5 convention. They cannot control that process as easily as they have already gained control over the existing government and political system we now have. So, I mean, I think things have gotten so bad that we need to use, you know, what the founders gave us in Article 5. I just don't see any alternative. I don't see how we get reforms from within the current corrupt two-party system.
Let me take issue a little bit with the conclusion that it's totally corrupt and that there is no... no possibility of reform within the current system. You've been working in the Congress and you've had some experience there, so clearly you're not speaking without some base of knowledge. But my experience has been that over the years, when you can have a sufficient national concern, as in a depression or an upheaval about the Vietnam War, or a resistance to the Cold War, there have been times in our history when the Congress has responded, and that there, in 2006, the Congress, they simply didn't respond sufficiently. So that if we were to get a substantial majority in the Senate and to keep the majority and increase it in the House, so we weren't dependent on Southern Democrats, we might very well be able to do the kinds of things in health care and education, and in the retraction of this war policy and the spending on Blackwater and people like that. Governor Richardson is talking about closing Guantanamo and bringing the troops out beginning immediately as soon as he takes office. Those are not things that suggest to me that we are totally corrupt or totally without hope. So where do you come to the conclusion that there's just no way to get through there?
Well, not only is it my conclusion, I would argue that most of the country is with me. Let's remember that only roughly half the electorate even bothers to vote anymore. I mean, most Americans have given up on the two-party system. When you look at the numbers of people who are now registered Republicans and Democrats, we're talking about a very small percent of the electorate. So, you know, I think most of the people don't have any more faith and confidence. And certainly I would argue that what the 2006 elections did and what Congress has done, what the democratically controlled Congress has done or not done, has even increased, you know, the number of people who no longer have any faith and trust in this two-party system. I mean, I don't think we can elect our way out of the current corrupt political system. I don't think voting for Democrats is any answer whatsoever. I mean, that's just my view, and I think it's the view of again, a large fraction of people who don't vote and who no longer subscribe or no longer loyal Democrats, if you will. I mean, they're just a huge fraction of the electorate that formerly, you know, saw themselves as voting most of the time democratically, but no longer, you know, feel that way at all. And I think this Congress has done a great deal to lose the trust and faith of much of the electorate. You know, I don't know how you can excuse. I mean, granted that, you know, we don't have a large, Democrats don't have a large majority in the Senate, I think this Congress could have done a whole lot more in the last year or so to put the brakes on the Bush administration in Iraq and a number of other things. I mean, when you look at many, many votes that where Bush has succeeded, you see enormous numbers of Democrats time and time again giving this Bush administration the power that it has sought. And so, I think the majority of Americans now, let's look at over 70% of the public thinks the nation is on the wrong track. I mean, you know, look at a lot of poll and survey data, and I would say that the country is definitely in the mood, obviously, for change, but they are pessimistic about getting the change that they want. from establishment politicians like Hillary Clinton and like Giuliani and, in fact, all the major candidates. And the minor candidates, the ones that the public seems to like because they come across as more honest and trustworthy, those minor candidates don't stand a chance of getting their party nomination. You know, I of all the Democrats in this primary season, I think Dennis Kucinich is probably the most honest and trustworthy person, and I must say I personally like a lot of his positions. And I think on the impeachment issue, he has definitely, earned the respect of a whole lot of us in the country that believe Bush and Cheney should have been impeached, and are very disappointed that Kucinich has not been more successful in the Congress with his impeachment effort. So, but my point is, I cannot imagine any scenario where Kucinich could get the Democratic nomination. I can't imagine any scenario where Ron Paul could get the Republican nomination. And that's just, the system isn't going to let that happen. It's just not possible. So we're going to see conventional politicians get the nominations, and we're going to see a continuation of conventional politicians retain their seats in Congress and the Senate. So, yes, I'm a complete pessimist when it comes to the current two-party system.
Well, there we are. That frames the difference quite well. My life experience has been one of some success in the organizing business and in the legal activity to reform civil rights and school integration, things of that kind. I think that the word corrupt is appropriate here, I think the system is corrupted by money beyond anything we've experienced in the past. I don't see that it's more corrupt than is possible to work our way out of. So I'm not yet ready with you, Joel, to toss in the towel. It seems to me that we've gone through a huge revolution in coalitions since Ronald Reagan and Richard Nixon aimed at collecting the South and bringing the South into the Republican stronghold and keeping Southern Democrats out of the majority, so that we now are faced with a reconsciousness building across the country, but largely because of the restraint and the stranglehold of the South. But I don't see that that's impenetrable or that we necessarily are going to lose forever. And there's one thing that does seem to have been rather clear in American politics, whether we're talking about the 1870s, the 1890s, and the populist revolts, the 1914 period of the uprisings of the people after the Depression, the 1930s, or in the late 1960s. We've seen over and over again in American politics, when things get bad enough, there is a common sense within the people that is strong enough to resist the bully pulpit of those maggots of industry that so often have been at the heart of the problem. So I look forward to a 2008 in which a substantial change would occur, no matter what Democrat is elected, and in which if it's a conservative Democrat like Hillary Clinton, she will be forced to move farther to the left. And if it's a good Democrat like John Edwards or Bill Richardson, I would say, or Dennis Kucinich, of course, but his chances are less likely. But I think either one of those other two, John Edwards, would make a radical change in American politics. So I don't agree that there is, as you suggest, no scenario under which we could succeed here. I think there are scenarios in which we could mightily succeed.
Well, I think, one of the things that's changed, I was trained as a scientist and engineer, and I think I have a pretty good sense of looking at the dynamics of a situation. And I would agree, that we can look at the American history and see a lot of examples of when things, turned around and became better. But one of my observations about our system, and I wrote a book about this titled Delusional Democracy, is that there's been a steady decline of our democracy, and that the population, the electorate, is much more manipulated and controlled now than ever before. And a lot of this, we have to go back to, looking at other aspects of the society that has changed, particularly the economic system. And that is, we have basically we're heading towards a two-class society. You know, we have a very rich upper class in this country. And one of the things that changed after World War II was that the rich people, the wealthy people in this country, increasingly and over the last several decades, took control of the political system. And so it's that control, and that's why I would say we have now a plutocracy more than a democracy, because we have a set of people, and it's a fairly statistically interesting, a large number of people. I mean, we have a population of 300 million, and there may be 10 or 20 million people who are pretty much in this wealthy upper class that have enormous political power, and that the population as a whole is now greatly manipulated and controlled, not just by government, you know, and political propaganda, but they're under economic control, too. Now, we have a population that is suffering from severe economic insecurity and are, you know, forced to work long hours, you know, and we just don't have a politically engaged population that we used to have. You know, I'm 68 years old, and I've seen these changes, you know, over the last half a century. It's this rich upper class, the plutocrats, that do not want a politically engaged population. And they got what they sought. And so now we have an easily manipulated population. And I, you know, and then we have all of this, you know, again, corrupting influence of money, so that even when some well-intentioned people gain public office, they become under the control, basically, of the moneyed interests. And so, yes, I'm very pessimistic. I mean, the people who have your point of view keep saying, well, give me the next election, and then give me the next election, and then it'll be, you know, the next election. And things have not been working out very well in terms of this two-party system. And a lot of the positive changes that you sort of made reference to happened in our history because of third parties. But what the two-party system has now done has reduced political competition. So it's virtually impossible for third-party candidates to rise up in our system as they did in the past and help turn the country around in a positive direction. I think that's very sad, but that's a structural change in the country, you know, over particularly the last half century. Look at the televised presidential debates that at one time third-party candidates could get into, and then the two major parties took control from the League of Women Voters and made it impossible for third-party candidates to get into those televised debates.
Joel, I'm going to have to interrupt. We've come to the end of our time. We've been talking to Joel Hirshhorn, National Press Secretary of Friends of the Article 5 Convention, mounting a campaign with now as many as maybe 1,000 followers around the country to convene an Article 5 convention under the Constitution and create, at a minimum, a national conversation about where this country is going, and at a maximum, a chance to reframe our whole system. More power to you, Joel, for pushing the conversation. Those of you who are listening who would like to participate in this conversation can call 206-337-0233 and leave your own comment, and we'd love to hear from you. I'm Craig Barnes. We've been talking to Joel Hirshhorn, Friends of the Article 5 Convention, and this is one of those great conversations that will continue indefinitely into the future until we get some change. Thank you, Joel.
Thank you, Craig.
You've been listening to A Nation Deceived, commentaries, conversations, and dialogues with Craig S. Barnes. Please come by www.anationdeceived.org to find out more, to participate in the blogs and the forums, and the conversation.